profitability has been restored, particularly in the largely predatory financial institutions, which have exploded during the neoliberal years and are now even bigger and richer than they were before the 2008 financial crisis, for which they were largely responsible. And as in the normal neoliberal fashion, they are happy to rely on extensive public subsidy. Does he get in trouble, the taxpayer will bail out.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on neoliberalism and accounting. Neoliberalism is an odd term when you think about it. It's hardly new, and it's not particularly liberal. It's been a great economic success story for the 1%. The detritus of neoliberalism litters the landscape, from smashed unions to shredded safety nets and deregulation of everything from airlines to banking to telecommunications. And how does one measure the human costs of shattered dreams and broken lives? The consequence? A backlash. Many working people are angry. Keep squeezing them, and they will be easy prey for charlatans and demagogues who exploit their vulnerability and fear with scapegoating and false promises. As The Nation magazine observes, alongside growing economic inequality, we have suffered growing political inequality, with a Princeton study declaring that the influence of ordinary citizens on policy is negligible. The United States, The Nation says, is becoming an oligarchy. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary MIT professor, practically invented modern linguistics. In addition to his pioneering work in that field, he's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. He's the author of scores of books, including a series I did with him, Propaganda in the Public Mind, How the World Works, and Power Systems. At 88, he still lectures widely. He spoke at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And now, Noam Chomsky.
Partway through the current experiment with neoliberalism, Jim Crotty provided an accounting of the record over, at that time, two decades of global economic performance since the onset of the neoliberal revolution. And I'll just quote the accounting. I wish it had been an epitaph, but it was just an accounting. They said, the evidence to date supports neoliberalism's critics. This is, incidentally, 2003. The promised benefits of neoliberalism have yet to materialize, at least for the majority of the world's people. Global income growth has slowed, as has the rate of growth of capital accumulation. Productivity growth has deteriorated. Real wage growth has declined. Inequality has risen in most countries, real interest rates are higher, financial crises erupt with increasing regularity, the less developed nations outside of East Asia have fallen even further behind the more advanced, and average unemployment has risen. East Asia, of course, is the region that didn't follow the rules. Other analysts since have drawn similar conclusions. The overall record was reviewed recently in a careful analysis by Mark Weisbrot, Dean Baker, David Rosnick of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They compare the Washington consensus years, 1980 to 2005, in their analysis, to the prior two decades, 1960 to 1980. And they found, I'm quoting, that contrary to popular belief, the past 25 years, 1980 to 2005, have seen a sharply slower rate of economic growth and reduced progress on social indicators for the vast majority of low and middle income countries. The latter, of course, is the anticipated consequence of the neoliberal programs of privatizing state functions, and it's not just true of the low and middle income countries. We see it very clearly in the United States. Among the OECD countries, the U.S. ranks just about at the bottom of 30 or so in social justice measures, ranks alongside Turkey, Greece, and Mexico. And there's no need to review the well-known scandal of U.S. health care, which incidentally is in violation of popular will, which continues to the present, remarkably, to support universal health care, despite virtually no articulate advocacy of this same stand, so quite recent polls once again reveal. Well, recall that these assessments are all, they're covering the period before the Great Crash. This is the period of the celebration of the Great Moderation, the triumph of efficient market and rational expectations theory, the virtual worship of St. Allen, perhaps the greatest economist since Adam Smith. And to his credit, Greenspan did keep a close eye on the economy. In 1997 testimony to the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan recognized, in his words, atypical restraint on compensation increases has been evident for a few years now and appears to be mainly the consequence of greater worker insecurity. Insecurity that, as he noted, was markedly increasing at that time, even as employment prospects improved, so it was deeply rooted. Greenspan predicted that these benign conditions of greater worker insecurity would be only temporary, and, as he put it, suppressed wage cost growth as a consequence of job insecurity could not last. Now, he was mistaken about that. 10 years later, in 2007, real wages for non-supervisory American workers were actually lower than they had been in 1979, when the neoliberal experiment, the current one, was just taking off. That's a pretty remarkable record over 30 years. I think it may be unprecedented. And recall that 2007 was the peak of euphoria and self-congratulation right before the entire intellectual edifice crashed to the ground. Well, other consequences of greater worker insecurity have recently come to light. One of them, an interesting one, followed immediately after Greenspan's Senate testimony in 1997. That's the dramatic increase in mortality among middle-aged white Americans without college degrees, beginning in 1999, recently documented by Ann Case and Angus Deaton. It's a phenomenon unknown apart from war and pestilence. They have an updated current analysis where they attribute the increase in mortality to despair and loss of status of working people under the neoliberal miracle, which are concomitants of heightened worker insecurity. Another such effect reached international prominence in November 2016, when the same sectors of the population that are suffering increased mortality turned for rescue to their bitter class enemy out of understandable but self-destructive desperation. And the consequences for working people are now being exhibited behind the facade of Trump bluster before the cameras. This is the systematic enactment of the Ryan legislative programs, which are unusually savage even for the ultra-right. And there's probably worse to come as further blows to working people are authorized by the Trump-Roberts Court, which is soon going to address the Friedrichs case, and now with Gorsuch on board, will probably decide to destroy public sector unions on fraudulent libertarian grounds. Well, just to show how far we've advanced in this respect during the neoliberal era, we might listen to the words of Dwight Eisenhower when he was running for president in 1952. Now, here's what he had to say. "I have no use for those, regardless of their political party, who hold some foolish dream of spinning the clock back to days when unorganized labor was a huddled, almost helpless mass. Today in America, unions have a secure place in our industrial life. Only a handful of unreconstructed reactionaries harbor the ugly thought of breaking unions. Only a fool would try to deprive working men and women of the right to join the union of their choice." Now that's conservatism, vintage 1952, the days of the golden age of regulated state capitalism. So we've come a long way since then. Well, Europe has not been spared the lash of neoliberalism, particularly after the 2008 crash, which unleashed the austerity programs of the Troika, the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission. The severe and harmful effects of these programs, particularly on the more vulnerable European periphery, have been very amply documented in excellent work by Mark Blith, Yanis Varoufakis, and Mark Weisbrot, among others. And the policies have been criticized as economically absurd, even by IMF economists. That's IMF economists. The IMF bureaucrats in the Troika listen to different voices, mainly the northern banks. Mark Weisbrot's investigations are particularly interesting. In his recent book, Failed, he provided clear evidence of a political agenda that's guiding the destructive economic policies. He did something quite interesting. He investigated the reports of the regular IMF consultations with member governments. This covers 27 countries for the years 2008 to 2011. He stopped in 2011 because right after that, in 2012, ECB President Mario Draghi uttered the magic words that ended the recurrent crises of the euro. He stated that the ECB would do whatever it takes to preserve the euro, and believe me, it will be enough. In fact, the words alone were enough. No acts were necessary, as had been evident from the outset. In the years before the magic words, Weisbrot discovered what he called a remarkably consistent and disturbing pattern from these IMF government consultations. He found in documents that the crisis was exploited as an opportunity to lock in the neoliberal reforms. Spending cuts in the public sector rather than tax increases, reduced benefits in public services, cuts in health care, undermining of collective bargaining, and in general moving to create a society, as he describes it, with less bargaining power for labor, lower wages, more inequality and poverty, a smaller government and social safety nets, and measures that reduce growth and employment. The IMF papers, Weisbrot concludes, detail the agenda of Europe's decision makers, and they have accomplished quite a lot in this respect over the past 5 years. The agenda is quite familiar here, and in fact everywhere where the neoliberal assault has proceeded. Of course, populations would not vote for these so-called reforms, as Weisbrot points out and is quite obvious, and that requires another element of the neoliberal program to be instituted. democracy must be sacrificed on the altar of locking in the neoliberal reforms. And the device in Europe is quite straightforward. Simply transfer decision-making to unelected bodies. All three members of the Troika, including the European Commission, are of course unelected. At the ideological level, there's also an assault necessary. The idea that people should have a role in determining their social and economic fate is one of the victims of neoliberal doctrine, necessarily. That's been revealed with unusual clarity in Europe, particularly when the Greek government dared to ask the opinion of the population about whether they agree that Greece should continue to be destroyed by so-called bailouts, which in fact pass through Greece without impact to pay off northern banks for their incompetence in providing careless and risky loans, while Greece's debt burden actually increases relative to GDP and the country is ruined. Not unfamiliar here either, in a different form. The reaction among European elites when the Greek government called for a referendum was utter outrage, and it got even more intense when the population voted the wrong way. And the Greeks were sternly punished for their illusion that democracy might have a place in neoliberal Europe, even in the country of its birth. The Troika conditions were made even harsher in reaction to this deviation from good order. There is, of course, a public response to the neoliberal assault in Europe has some resemblance to what's been happening here. Centrist political institutions are discredited. Public disillusionment, fear, anger are running high, sometimes taking quite ominous forms, much more ominous in Europe than here, in fact. Those who are old enough to remember the 1930s, as I do, in fact, cannot fail to be alarmed at the rise of neo-fascist parties, even in Austria and Germany, of all places, and not only there. And bitter memories are not easy to suppress when a majority of Europeans call for banning of all Muslims from Europe, and many want to reverse the real achievements of the European Union, such as free movement of populations and erosion of national borders, which is incidentally quite consistent with strengthening of cultural diversity. Well, we can't attribute all of these developments across the West to the neoliberal assault, but it is a common and I think clearly significant factor. In the United States too, functioning democracy has declined under the neoliberal assault. These are developments that are revealed with particularly in detailed studies by Martin Gillens, Ben Page, Larry Bartlett, a couple of other political scientists. The results show that the majority of the population, about 70%, the lower 70% on the income scale, are literally disenfranchised. That is, their representatives pay no attention whatsoever to their attitudes and preferences. As you move up the scale, you get a little more influence, and at the very top, policies are set by a fraction of 1%. The significance of these results has been further underscored by recent work by Tom Ferguson and his colleagues. This is extending Ferguson's investment theory of politics to a new domain, congressional elections since 1980, neoliberal years. And the studies show something pretty astonishing. They show that this is House and Senate. They show that campaign spending is a near perfect predictor of electoral outcomes. If you take a look at the study, it's literally a straight line effect over all of these years. And these are results you don't find in the social sciences, maybe in quantum physics. But then it appears to be enhanced by the neoliberal assault on democracy, which is reasonable because it's implicit in the general principles, as you see also in Europe. Well, of course, there has been resistance to the neoliberal assault, particularly in Latin America. The center-left governments that took power during this millennium have gone a considerable way towards reversing the lost decades, as they're called, of the neoliberal years, the structural adjustment years, the Washington consensus years. One consequence, and I think an important and lasting one, is that the IMF, which is basically an agency of the U.S. Treasury in Latin America, has been expelled. It's gone. Gives loans to Europe now. And also all your U.S. military bases have been expelled from South America, even Colombia, surprisingly. There has been some progress in reversing the harm caused by the Washington consensus programs of the lost decades. Regrettably, there have also been severe failures resulting from caudillism, corruption, and reliance on an unsustainable extractivist model, which as a side effect undermines domestic development. So you import, export soy and import Chinese manufacturers, which destroys your own manufacturing base, so on. One of the better records is in Ecuador, where poverty has been reduced by almost 40%, and extreme poverty by almost 50%, along with notable reduction in inequality, growth of per capita income, a substantial increase in social spending, and access to health care and education. And elsewhere, too, there have been advances that may be sustainable despite the current regression. Well, not every Latin American country participated in the reversal of the neoliberal assault, or reforms, as they're, to use the preferred term. One prime exception is Mexico, which was subjected to a policy decision called NAFTA, which had the express purpose, literal purpose, of locking Mexico in to the structural reforms of the 1980s. And the effects happened to be reviewed in a recent CEPR study. It finds that Mexico ranks 15th out of 20 Latin American countries in growth of real GDP per person. Real wages are the same in 2014 when the study ends as in 1994 when NAFTA was instituted. The poverty rate has barely budged, while in the rest of the region, poverty declined from 44% in 2002 to 28% in 2014. And there's a string of other results which confirm the general assessment of the neoliberal programs. The modern experiment with neoliberalism was initiated in Chile after the Pinochet coup in 1973 overthrew the Allende government and installed a harsh dictatorship. That's called in Chile the first 9/11. It took place in 9/11, 1973. And what happened is quite informative about what followed worldwide and about the essence of these programs. The U.S. Had, of course, strongly opposed the Allende government, and it celebrated the new military dictatorship with enthusiasm. Among other punishments, loans had been withheld during the period of Chilean democracy, but 9/11, 1973, pulled the cork out of the bottle, and there was a flood of loans from the World Bank and private investors. The new military rulers were praised by U.S. Secretary of Treasury William Simon for having brought economic freedom to Chile. The applause was reminiscent of Washington's reaction to the military coup in Brazil in 1964. That established the first of the neo-Nazi terror and torture states that spread like a hideous plague across the hemisphere of the curse, reaching Central America in the 1980s. John F. Kennedy's ambassador, Lincoln Gordon, explained that Washington supported the military forces that overthrew parliamentary democracy in recognition, I'm quoting, in recognition of their basically democratic and pro-United States orientation. Now, those two terms are synonymous. While the torturers and the assassins were carrying out their necessary work of cleansing the society, Gordon hailed their achievement as the most decisive victory for freedom in the mid-20th century. Now remember, this is the left of the political spectrum that we're talking about. The Democratic Rebellion, as Gordon called it, he then cabled Washington, would also help in restraining left-wing excesses of the former moderate elected government, and the Democratic forces now in charge should create a greatly improved climate for private investment, the bottom line. The United States is a global power. We mislead ourselves when we tend to focus on a particular area. We should think globally. And policies and attitudes tend to be consistent worldwide for that reason. Well, the Pinochet dictatorship, going back to that, they brought in the famous Chicago Boys, economists who were trained in the doctrines of the leading proponents of neoliberalism. Well, the experiment went on for a few years. By 1982, the results of the experiment were in. The economy completely crashed. In order to salvage something from the neoliberal wreckage, the state had to take over a large part of the economy. This is one prominent Chilean economist who studied this carefully, Gabriel Palma, points out that the Pinochet government ended up with a share of the economy far greater than the Allende's government ever dreamed of. Basically, the whole of the banking system ended up owned by the government, and a large share of the real sector as well, including export activities, manufacturing services, and so on. This was, some of you may remember, that this was called at the time the Chicago Road to Socialism. Pinochet then recognized the disaster. He sacked the Chicago Boys. He brought in entrepreneurs of the traditional old right to try to set the economy back to some kind of functioning, as it does, still relying very heavily on copper and in particular. Well, the Chilean experiment with neoliberalism and shock therapy was soon followed by others. The most significant one was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. U.S. advisors moved in, administered shock therapy, and accord with neoliberal principles, imposition of privatization, decontrol of prices, general market doctrines. And the result was the familiar one, economic collapse, loss of about half of Russia's GDP in 5 years, also a sharp increase in the death rate, reaching millions of excess deaths, and robbery of state assets on a colossal scale, largely by the old apparatchiks, leading to the corrupt oligarchy and the Putin reaction. So that's another grand success. And as we've seen, hardly untypical, or for that matter, hardly surprising.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on neoliberalism and accounting. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And I began by saying that the Chilean dictatorship opened the first modern experiment with neoliberalism. And the reason for the qualification modern is that it's not really new. Similar socioeconomic regimes have been imposed by imperial powers for centuries, pretty much creating the third world. And in fact, neoliberalism is a strange term. In many respects, it's not new, and it's not particularly liberal, even in the technical economic sense. Well, there's no time to review the historical record, which is indeed quite interesting and remarkably consistent. What it reveals is that quite generally, from England to the United States to Japan, Japan, incidentally, the one country of the global south that was not colonized and not by accident, the one country that developed and that rejected the neoliberal principles, from England all the way through to the East Asian tigers, the countries that have developed are those that simply rejected the neoliberal principles. For the United States, these were advised by no less an economist than Adam Smith, who advised the New Republic to follow the principles of sound economics, to concentrate on what they're good at, what was later called comparative advantage, to import superior manufactured goods from England, crucially not to try to monopolize the products that they had an advantage in. The crucial one, of course, was cotton, the fuel of the Industrial Revolution. And if the policies had been followed, the United States would be part of the third world. But they were instantly rejected. The Hamiltonian model immediately imposed the highest protectionist tariffs in the world and enabled the development of a textile industry, of manufacturing, and later in the century, a steel industry. And in fact, the U.S. also sought and almost succeeded in monopolizing cotton. That was critical. And the reasoning was very explicit. You go to the Jacksonian presidents, Polk and Tyler, they were quite explicit at the fact that if we can monopolize cotton, we can bring England to our feet. And remember, England was the big enemy in those days. It had the great power. And if we could only get a monopoly of cotton, we could ensure that England would not get in our way, would do what we want. They came pretty close, not quite, because England, at the time of its own dallying with market principles, decided that it would conquer the rest of India so that it could try to gain a substantial amount of cotton, and of course also get control of the opium that it could use to batter its way into China, which didn't want British manufacturing goods. Now, that's all called free market principles in economic history. But that's essentially the typical record, goes right on to the present. The United States was independent. It followed England's model of state-led development and protectionism, what we now call robbing superior technology from others, in England's case from India, from Ireland, and the Low Countries, in the U.S. case from England. And there was, as I say, some dallying with free trade now and then when it looked as if it would be advantageous. These are the countries that were free from imperial domination. The countries that were under imperial domination were compelled by force to pursue these doctrines, and they became the third world. Individual cases are quite interesting to look at, but just to take one, the United States, the new United States and Egypt, were pretty similar in the early 19th century. They both had ample resources of cotton, the basis for the Industrial Revolution. Egypt was a rich agricultural country, that's why Napoleon conquered it. Egypt had a developmental leader, Muhammad Ali, was planning to pursue the course of development that the United States successfully did and that England had done before it. But there was one difference. The United States was independent. Egypt was under British rule. And Lord Palmerston and others made it very clear that they were not going to tolerate an independent economy in the Eastern Mediterranean. So they blocked it by force. Won't go on with the rest of the story, but it goes on up to even U.S. intervention in the post-Second World era. So Egypt is Egypt, and the United States is the United States. And there are many similar pairs, which are quite interesting to look at. So just take one. African historians, including British African historians, Basil Davidson, famous African historian, have argued with some plausibility that the West African Ashanti Kingdom in the mid-19th century was quite similar to Japan in the level of economic and social development and policy formation and so on, again with one critical difference, the usual one. Japan is Japan, Africa is Africa. Well, history is a complicated matter, and there are many obscure interactions, but these are among the clearest lessons that economic history provides, and they're known to mainstream economic historians. So, among others, Paul Baruch amply documents his conclusion that it's difficult to find another case where the facts so contradict the dominant theory as the doctrine that free markets are the engine of growth. There have been some notable successes of the modern experiment with neoliberal reforms. Recall that these were instituted back in the 70s in large part in order to arrest the declining rate of profit, which was due to more popular power, particularly labor power, during the activist years of the 60s. And that's been achieved. Profitability has been restored, particularly in the largely predatory financial institutions, which have exploded during the neoliberal years and are now even bigger and richer than they were before the 2008 financial crisis, for which they were largely responsible. And as in the normal neoliberal fashion, they are happy to rely on extensive public subsidy. There was an IMF study a couple of years ago which investigated the profits of the six biggest American banks and concluded that they come almost entirely from the implicit government insurance policy, which is not just the bailouts, but access to cheap credit and easy funding, incentives to take risky, hence profitable, transactions, because you get in trouble, the taxpayer will bail you out. The business press, Bloomberg, looking at the IMF study, estimated the annual subsidy at about over $80 billion a year, which sounds high, but isn't really. Another IMF study found that the fossil fuel industries get about a $700 billion a year subsidy. That's free market in the really existing capitalist democracy. Well, but there have been notable successes. The financial institutions have exploded. They're very wealthy, bigger than before. Inequalities increased. Rate of profits increased. And there are other successes that are insufficiently appreciated and should be looked at much more carefully. In fact, some of them have been studied carefully by political economist Sean Starrs in recent work of his, actually at MIT. He points out that the conventional estimates of national wealth in terms of GDP are quite misleading in the era of neoliberal globalization. This is an era with complex integrated supply chains, subcontracting, all sorts of other devices. And in this system, he discovered, corporate ownership of the world's wealth is becoming a much more realistic measure of global power than national wealth as the world departs even more than before from the model of nationally discrete political economies. So he did a detailed investigation of corporate ownership using Credit Suisse and other sources, and he found that in virtually every economic sector, manufacturing, finance, services, retail, and others, U.S. corporations are well in the lead in ownership of the global economy, either first or occasionally second. Nobody else is even close. Overall, U.S. corporate ownership of the global economy is close to 50% of the total world economy. Notice that that's roughly the maximum estimate of U.S. national wealth in 1945. That was the historical peak of U.S. power. Well, national U.S. wealth by conventional measures has declined from 1945 to the present, maybe 20% or so today. But U.S. corporate ownership of the world has exploded. And the multinationals, of course, are nationally based, supported and subsidized by the national taxpayer. So in some respects, all is quite well. Neoliberalism has been a grand success. And I can end by quoting the head of state of Brazil's military dictatorship, General Emilio Medici, 1971. He said, "The economy is doing fine, but the people aren't," which is perhaps the simplest one-sentence accounting of neoliberalism.
Do you see any potentially serious challenges to the current order on the horizon at this time?
Let's take the United States. One of the most remarkable developments in the last couple of months was the Bernie Sanders campaign, which is quite astonishing. And I quoted Tom Ferguson's discussion of congressional elections, but it's much more general. For over a century, American elections have been bought. You can almost completely predict electoral outcomes and policy by simply looking at things like campaign funding and the coalitions of investors, as Ferguson puts it, who coalesce to invest to control the state. It's a remarkably close prediction. Now let's come to last November. A guy came up from nowhere. No one ever heard of him. No corporate funding, no wealthy funding. The media hated him, disparaged him. He even used a scare word, socialist, which meant basically New Deal Democrat. He probably would have won the Democratic nomination if it hadn't been for the Obama-Clinton shenanigans and managing the party. He might have won the election. It's a radical break from the American political tradition. And it goes beyond. Thanks to Fox News, of all people, we have an account of the most of the relative popularity of political figures in the United States. Sanders is way in the lead. Nobody else is even close. And among young people, much higher than anyone else. Well, that's the basis for a kind of resistance. There are plenty of possibilities. And similar things are happening in Europe. So I mentioned the quite ominous right-wing developments, but there are others. Podemos, Jeremy Corbyn, Varoufakis's movement, GEM25, these are all live and well. They could respond. Latin America was the case that had the most successful resistance. There's regression, but that's not over. So I think there's plenty of possibilities.
So how do you place Trumpism into this story? Do you see it as something different, a more right-wing, neo-fascist kind of assault on this? Or?
I think it does Trump too much credit to call him neo-fascist. But to be a neo-fascist, you have to have an ideology. And as far as I can see, his ideology is simply me. I mean, there are forces that he's awakened. I mean, they're not really awakened. They're already there, but kind of opened the door for, which are pretty dangerous. But I don't think, I mean, in my feeling at least, the threat of neo-fascism is much greater in Europe, where it has a history, a basis, an institutional basis, could come back. I think what's happening here is somewhat different. I think it is pretty much what Case and Deaton pointed out, desperation. There's all kind of factors. One factor is evangelical Christianity. which is a huge phenomenon in the United States. And it hadn't been, it's become essentially the base of the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party went so far to the right that they can't get votes on their actual policies. Nobody's going to vote for the Ryan legislative program. So they've had to mobilize people on other grounds, nationalist, ultra-religious, and so on. And that's there. But a large part of the slight swing, and it was pretty slight in the last election, was working class, lower middle class, not the very poor, but people who have lost their hope, their dignity, their sense of self-worth, and see the whole world as against them. They're being attacked from below by worthless people who, as they see it, are being helped by the federal government, attacked from above by the rich people who are taking everything, don't have jobs, their social status is gone, mortality is increasing, desperation is increasing. So they turn to their class enemy. Where else are they going to go? The Democratic Party abandoned the working class 40 years ago. In fact, a lot of these people voted for Obama, believing the rhetoric about hope and change. Okay, no hope, no change. By 2010, right here in Massachusetts, there was already a reversal. A lot of union households voted for Brown on the seat that Kennedy had. It was quite a change, and the studies of their voting showed that a lot of it was just anger at Obama. He was attacking their the rights that they had struggled for, like health rights, and he wasn't doing anything for them. So they turned to Brown. This time they turned to Trump. What's going to be interesting to see and could lead to something like neo-fascism, I think, is what will happen when the con game collapses. Sooner or later, working people are going to see that the programs that are being instituted are directed against them, case by case. You know, it's kind of hidden behind the bluster. But if you take a look at the programs, the Ryan-style programs, it's exactly what they are. So sooner or later, that game's going to collapse. And then what happens? Probably scapegoating. Maybe some wild action, maybe the kind of thing that could inspire some kind of ultra-right xenophobic movement.
How has the privatization of public colleges and universities affected the development of a popular alternative to neoliberalism?
Public funding for universities has sharply declined. State funding for the state universities has gone way down. Tuitions have gone way up. I don't think you can find any economic reason for this. If you take a look at around the world, the most successful state capitalist economy in the world is Germany. Education's free. The country that ranks at the top, or close to the top, on all international studies is Finland. Education's free. Go right south of the border, Mexico, poor country. UNAM, national universities, quite high quality. I mean, salaries are horrendous, but you have to have a couple of jobs if you want to teach. But the educational research level is quite impressive. It's free. Take the United States. I mean, in the 1950s, the United States is a much poorer country than it is today, far poorer. Education was basically free. The GI Bill offered not only free education, but even subsidy to huge numbers of people. Of course, it was racially based. You had to be white to get an education which they never would have been able to get themselves. It was very good for them, was very good for the country. It's part of the reason for the success of those years. In fact, even private universities were very inexpensive. In 1945, when I went to college, I went to the University of Pennsylvania, you know, Ivy League University. Tuition was $100 a year, which is, and you could easily get a scholarship. You know. take a look across the board, it's hard to imagine there can possibly be an economic reason for this. You can think of reasons, non-economic reasons, like trapping students. Now, go back to the early 70s and take a look at the elite reaction to the activism of the 60s. It's really worth reading closely. There, two major publications came out in the early 70s, the opposite ends of the spectrum, about the terrible time of the 60s. It was called the Time of Troubles, you remember. And it was a troubling time. The country was getting a lot more civilized, and that's pretty dangerous. You don't want that to happen. And there was a reaction from both ends of the spectrum. At the right end, and these are, if you haven't read them, I'd really urge reading these things. At the right end of the spectrum was the Powell Memorandum. Lewis Powell, who was a corporate lawyer, worked for tobacco companies and so on. Nixon later appointed him to the Supreme Court. He wrote a memorandum, which was secret, but it leaked. It was to the Chamber of Commerce. You really have to see the rhetoric. The rhetoric is even more interesting than the content. The rhetoric is like a spoiled three-year-old who thinks he ought to have the whole world, and somebody took a piece of candy from him, so you have a tantrum. You know, that's exactly what the rhetoric is like. He says, look, the business world is being destroyed, he says. The colleges have been taken over by the far left, led by Herbert Marcuse, who's organizing the whole university system. The media have been taken over by the far left. Everything's collapsing. The business world is a little embattled sector, you know, which is being beaten down everywhere. And he says, well, we got it. He says, we don't really have to accept this, because if you look at it, we're the ones who have the funding. We're the trustees. We're the regents, you know. We can fight back and defend ourselves from this assault. Actually, it's not just Marcuse. The other one was Ralph Nader with the consumer advocacy campaigns. This is just destroying the entire free enterprise system. So that's from the far right. Then you go to the left, which is more interesting. That's the study, Crisis of Democracy, that came out from the Trilateral Commission. Trilateral Commission are liberal internationalists from Europe, the United States, and Japan. It's basically the Carter administration, which was staffed almost entirely from that group. It's that segment. And their picture is the same. The rhetoric is different. It's more moderate and civilized and bigger words and so on. But it's basically the same story. It says the 60s undermined democracy. That's the crisis of democracy. The crisis of democracy is that most people are supposed to be passive and apathetic and let their betters run things. But they're getting out in the streets, they're demonstrating, women, young people, old people, farmers, you know, the special interests, meaning everybody. And the American rapporteur is Samuel Huntington, you know, authentic liberal political scientist. And he kind of looks back with nostalgia to the Truman years when he says, I'm almost quoting, he says, Truman was able to run the country with the help of a few Wall Street lawyers and financiers. And then democracy was functioning. There was no problem. But now we've got all these people, you know, pressing the government, and it's too much pressure on the government. So we need more moderation in democracy. And he goes on to the universities. The whole group does. Huntington formulates it. He says there's a problem with what they call the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. Okay. This is the liberals I'm quoting. There are institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, the universities, the schools, you know, the churches, and they're failing. You can see it from the fact that all these young people are out there demonstrating and protesting and raising questions and so on. So we got to do something to indoctrinate the young better. Well, I don't know if you can draw a direct connection, but the fact is that raising tuitions and imposing massive debt and so on does have the impact of indoctrinating the young. You're trapped, I don't have to tell you, for obvious reasons. And I think all of this is just part of the whole neoliberal policy. It's a collection of ideas that kind of fit together, you know. Don't want to say somebody sat down and spelled it all out, but they just naturally fit together. And I think what's happening in the universities is part of it. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
That was Noam Chomsky on neoliberalism and accounting. He spoke at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. The legendary MIT professor has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as David Corton, Vandana Shiva, Arun Gandhi, Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Bill McKibben. We also have an enormous archive of Noam Chomsky recordings and some books, too. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.